All right, if you want to grab your Bibles, we are going to be finishing Matthew chapter 7 this morning and finishing the Sermon on the Mount. This is the end of this Bible class session that we've been involved in. And so I hope that you have enjoyed this study through the Sermon on the Mount. I appreciate Kirk so much filling in for the last 2 weeks. And Kirk did his normal outstanding job on the end of chapter 6 and the beginning of chapter 7. So appreciate Kirk doing that. And you know, sometimes a teacher needs to come back in and reteach or go back over materials after somebody's kind of filled in for him. But I never feel that way with Kirk. He always does an outstanding job. And so as we come to Matthew chapter 7, and as we are looking to finish this sermon, just some reminders about some things that we have seen, some places we've been in this study. You think about, we've been studying this. This is our ninth lesson on the Sermon on the Mount, and yet Jesus preached this sermon. I don't know how long you think it took him. How long does it take you to read it? And if you're not speed reading, how long does it take you to read it? Jesus preached this sermon in one setting. We've taken nine classes to look at this sermon, and yet we could have taken 19 classes in looking at this sermon just to spend time digesting all that Jesus said. So imagine you hear Jesus preach this sermon and you go back home. Now, be careful how you answer this question. Do you and your wife, do you and your husband ever talk about the sermon? You ever go to lunch and you're talking about the sermon with people at lunch? Now, I'm telling you, be careful how you answer that question. You're not talking about the preacher. You would never talk bad about the preacher. I'm just talking about the sermon. Do you ever talk about the sermon? You know, what did you think about that? Or, you know, he said this. Can you imagine going home after Jesus preached this sermon? Would you be talking about it? Did you hear him say this? What do you think he meant by that? We've said as we've gone through this class that this, a lot of what is here in Matthew 5, 6, and 7 is also over in Luke chapter 6, Luke chapter 11. But it's all throughout the teachings of Jesus, because Jesus had to wrap around and teach the same thing again. Do you think they got it the first time he said it? No, he didn't. They didn't get it. Do you get it the first time? And so he would have to come around and teach this again. But imagine hearing Jesus preach this sermon and you go home. Do you have some things to think about? Do you have some things to do some kind of introspection on your life and say, wow, is that me? Am I truly poor in spirit? Am I truly meek? Do I truly hunger and thirst after righteousness? Am I truly a peacemaker? Am I pure in heart? I mean, you could go home and just focus on the Beatitudes and think, okay, I got to work on those. And yet he wasn't done when he got done with the Beatitudes. He sets that stage, the first part of the sermon, about here's the kind of heart that a Christian needs to have. Here's the kind of character that the Christian needs to develop. And he builds upon that to say, okay, when the Christian learns to have that kind of heart and that kind of character, it's going to draw negative attention to him. There are going to be people that are going to persecute him, not because of how good he is, but because of the life that he's living. There's going to be people that persecute him. And so how should a Christian respond to persecution? What does Jesus say in Matthew chapter 5? Rejoice and be exceedingly glad. Is that our common response to negative attention to our Christian lives? But Jesus says, we need to rejoice. Did the apostles rejoice, Acts chapter 5, when they were put before the Sanhedrin, tried, they were beaten, they were threatened, they were further threatened. And they got out of prison in Acts chapter 5, verse 41 and 42, and they rejoiced that they were found worthy to suffer for his name. It's not just that. What I want you to see is this isn't just theory. What Jesus is preaching is not just theory. It's not just, oh, here's some good ideas. We see it put into practice even there in the life of the apostles. But Jesus told them, you need to be mindful of your influence. The influence that you have on others. It's not just a matter of your relationship with God, but how does your relationship with God impact others around you? It needs to positively impact them. So much so that when people look at you, they need to see a true, genuine Christian. Do they? Now, I'm not talking about on Sundays. Do they see a true, genuine Christian? They see you loading up. We got in our car this morning as it was starting to rain, and you know there's our neighbors, you know, riding their bikes down the street. Did they see a couple people dressed that, you know, we were dressed a little bit differently than they were? Do you have a positive influence other than on Sundays? Do others know that you're a Christian? If somebody showed up here on a Sunday, maybe from your workplace, and they saw you here, would they be surprised? Oh, they go to church? Wow, I didn't even know that. Wouldn't have expected that. It has happened where individuals have come to church, not necessarily here, but in other places, like, oh, wow, okay. Didn't occur to me. Do we recognize that we need to have an influence, a positive godly influence on everybody? And that's what Jesus is talking about. Let your light shine, and you're the light of the world and the salt of the earth. And so Christianity's got to be real to us, and that's what the Sermon on the Mount is about. It's got to be real to us. And so Christianity is not just something that we do on the outside, and this is Matthew chapter 5 and verse 20, and we've talked about this verse probably in every class because it's a key verse in the sermon, where Jesus says, your righteousness must exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. Your righteousness cannot merely be external. Your righteousness cannot just focus on the traditions of man and not on the law of God. Your righteousness cannot just pick and choose which parts of the law it wants to obey. You've got to be fully committed. Are we? And if we're fully committed, Jesus says, here's some things you're going to do. You're going to be mindful that, yeah, murder is wrong, but guess what? So is hating your brother. And adultery is wrong, but so is lusting after a woman to have relations with her. And so he goes through the rest of chapter 5 to say, it's not just these outward actions. It starts with your heart. We've got to be committed. We've got to be converted, not just being baptized and becoming a Christian, but we've got to be fully converted to living that Christian life. And so you get to chapter 6, and what does he talk about in chapter 6? Talks about our giving, talks about our praying, talks about our fasting, and you notice in those verses that Jesus does not say, if you give, and if you pray, and if you fast. You don't have the word if in those verses. What word do you have? When. So it's not, well, you know, here's an idea, so if you choose to do it, okay, so be it. Jesus doesn't say if. He says when you do these things. These Christian disciplines ought to be a part of our lives. And so he says, when you do these things, don't do them to be seen of men. What did he say about those hypocrites who were giving and praying and fasting? What did he say about them who were doing it to be seen of men? What do they have? They have their reward. They've got their reward. We talked about when we went through those verses that was an accounting term that meant that something had been paid in full. So if you want to do something to be seen of men, what does Jesus say? Go for it, and you're going to be paid in full. You'll get everything you're looking for. You'll get the attention of men. Is that going to be everything that you need? No, that's nothing that you need. What you need is the attention of God, and that's what he says, is that you give and you pray and you fast to be seen of your Father in heaven. That's our focus. And so he talks, when you get down, as he's developing that section, to say you need to focus in on your heart and how you're living. He says what that's going to help you to do is to have the proper relationship with material things. Matthew chapter 6, verse 19, 20, and 21. He talks about laying up treasures in heaven. How do you lay up treasures in heaven? I mean, you just talk to your financial advisor and say, hey, you know, can you take some of that out of my paycheck? Yeah, get it pre-tax and make sure you lay that up in heaven for me. Can your financial advisor take care of that for you? I don't think that's how it works. Well, he can help you lay up treasures on earth, right? How do you lay up treasures in heaven? By doing good deeds. What'd you say over here? By your works. By your obedience, and we're going to get to that at the end of chapter 7 today. By how you serve the Lord, you're laying up treasures in heaven. By how you treat others, you're laying up treasures in heaven. What did Jesus say about, as you've done it unto the one of the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto who? You've done it unto me, Jesus says. So if you're doing something unto Jesus, is that laying up treasure in heaven? And so he says, when you have your focus upon having your heart right with God, not being concerned about getting people patting you on the back, being seen of men, when you have your focus set upon heaven, it's going to help you have your focus not set on material things. So he talks about being generous. Your eye, he talks about having a good eye or an evil eye, and there he's talking about being generous in what you have. Remember what Paul said in Ephesians 4, verse 28, where he says, "Let him who stole steal no longer, but let him work that he may have to give to those who have a need." Sometimes we think we need to work so that we can have. Paul didn't put a period there, work so that you can have. Sometimes we think we need to work so that we can have for us. That's not what he says. Scripture says we need to work so that we can have, so that we can help other people. That's what Jesus is talking about in Matthew chapter 6. And so he says in verse 24 that you need to choose who you're going to serve. Are you going to serve materialism? Are you going to serve the things of this world? Or are you going to serve Jesus? And as Kirk said 2 weeks ago, as he got into that section about worry, when you set your mind truly on where it needs to be, is it going to help you to deal with worry in your life? If we set our mind on things above, not on things of this earth, if we truly cast our cares upon God, for He cares for us, should that help us with our anxiety, with our worry? It should, if we're truly doing it. If we're truly setting our sights on things above, if we're truly casting our cares upon Him, then we truly ought to be laying up treasures there and saying, you know what? I'm going to let God take care of this. And when we let God take care of things in our lives, what will God do for us? Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and what's He going to do? He's going to supply what you need. So instead of worrying about the things of this life, when we focus on our relationship with God, He will take care of those things that we might worry about. And so you get to chapter 7. And in chapter 7, don't remember, chapter divisions were put in later. Don't look at it and say, oh, wow, look, there's three different chapters. There's three different concepts here. This is one sermon. And again, sometimes people looked at it and said, no, there's too many pieces and parts to this. This is just a compilation. This isn't a compilation. Jesus is trying to share with these individuals some concepts that they need to get for daily living. And in their daily life, in their relationship with others, they need to be mindful that they don't go around simply being one who would focus on the faults of others without looking in the mirror and say, wait a minute, I've got faults myself. I've got to make some corrections in my own life so that I can help others. Jesus is not saying don't judge anybody else. Well, that's, as Kirk said last week, that's one of the most quoted and the most misquoted verses in all of the Bible. And yet, what do we do sometimes? Jesus says focus on yourself. Make sure you're making corrections in your life so that you can help somebody else make corrections in their life. Why? So that we can all help each other get to heaven. Isn't that our goal? To help each other get to heaven? And so as we do that, we are to be doing unto others, not as they do unto us, but doing unto others as we want them to do unto us. Helping others to see Christ living in us. Did Jesus live the golden rule, or did He just teach the golden rule? Did Jesus do unto others as He would have liked them to do unto Him? He didn't always get the good in return, but we don't always get the good in return either. And so our trust needs to be in God, knowing that when we ask and when we seek and when we knock, He's going to answer. He's going to take care of us. And so when you get to verse 13, this is not a brand new section where He's entering into something He hasn't been dealing with. I think in verse 13, He's starting to wrap up the sermon. Now, as you look at it, you think, boy, He's got a lot of sermon left. Have you ever heard a preacher who started to wrap up his sermon but still had a lot of sermon left? That's Jesus here. And so He's getting towards, He's not going to extend the invitation. At least we don't think He is. We don't see that here. But He's saying to them, folks, you need to focus in on where you are headed. You need to focus in on your eternity. And He's been dealing with that all along. And He gets to the end of this and He says, you've got to be focused on where you're going. Are you going to heaven? Sometimes people depict Jesus as some kind of a, you know, just kind of a weak individual. Do you picture Jesus as being weak, cowardly, pushover kind of guy? Is that the kind of guy you see him? I mean, physically, do you picture Jesus being kind of a weakling? I mean, or do you picture him being kind of buff like me? I mean, when you, why are you laughing? How do you picture Jesus? What did Jesus do for 30 years before he started his ministry? He's a carpenter. Dirk, where'd you get all your muscles? I mean, you go to the gym every morning, right? I mean, you work out every night. You're doing 100 push-ups before you go to bed at night, right? I'm sure of it, right? When you think about a carpenter, what do you think about? Think about somebody that's got muscles naturally because of the hard work that they're doing. When you picture Jesus, is this guy tough? It's got to be tough. You picture his hand. When you picture shaking Jesus' hands, if you shook his hands, would he have callus on his hands? Would they be rough hands from being a carpenter for all of those years? He's not some kind of a weak pushover. Now, what about in his teaching? Was Jesus like, oh, well, you know, just kind of love each other. You know, that's all that matters. Just be kind of nice to people. And if you're nice, that's all I'm asking. Sometimes that's how we depict the teachings of Jesus. You get to the end of this sermon. When you get to the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is directing his eyes at these individuals to tell them, not everybody's going to heaven. In fact, most people are not. Is that a nice thing to say? I mean, is that, when you get up and say, most people are going to hell, is that how you win friends and influence people? I mean, if Dale Carnegie could have just been in the first century, he could have helped Jesus out, right? No. What's Jesus trying to help these people to do? Trying to help them get to heaven. And so as we look at these closing verses, look in verses 13 and 14, as we think about this, as Jesus focuses in on helping these individuals to focus on eternity, he says, you've got to choose what path you're going to walk. And all throughout these last verses, from verse 13 down through verse 27, there's choices that have to be made. In every one of these, there's a choice on what path you've got to follow. There's a choice in what teacher you're going to listen to. There's a choice when you get down to verse 21. There's a choice about what kind of life you're going to live. You get down to verse 24, there's a choice about what kind of builder, what kind of hearer you are going to be. All throughout this last section, Jesus is saying, you've got to make a choice. And he again, don't think he's just saying that here. He said that before, chapter 6 and verse 24. No man can serve two masters. You've got to choose who you're going to serve. But here he's saying, you've got to choose what path you're going to walk on. The Greek word for do, we have the English word do, D-O, or the word make is also another translation. The Greek word for that is going to appear about 9 times in these last verses. What does that indicate about having our perspective set on heaven? What does that indicate about making choices? If you've got the word do 9 times, he's saying, you've got to listen to what I'm saying, and you've got to obey what I'm saying in order to go to heaven. And so these verses are some of the most familiar, I'm sure, to you in the Sermon on the Mount. You get to verse 13, and he talks about the narrow gate. You think about narrow gate. Is that visual? Jesus was a visual teacher. He says, enter by the narrow gate. And then in verse 13, he drops in and starts talking about the wide gate. And then in verse 14, he comes back to talking about that narrow gate. Jesus says, enter by the narrow gate. Over in Luke chapter 13, in verse 24, Jesus said, strive to enter into that. And that word strive over in Luke 13 and verse 24 is the Greek word agonizomai. We get the word agony or agonize from that. Agonize to enter into the narrow gate. What does that indicate to you? There's a struggle involved. And that's when you get down to verse 14 and Jesus says, narrow is the gate and difficult is the way. I don't know what word. Different translations, you may have the word difficult there. in chapter 7, verse 24, narrow is the way, difficult. Even some translations would have the word narrow instead of the word difficult. That word there means that there is a struggle involved. It means if you spell the word straight, not like a straight line, but you spell it S-T-R-A-I-T, what does that word mean? It means narrow. When you hear about the Straits of Gibraltar, Straits of, what are we talking about here? We're talking about a narrow passage. And in that day, there were narrow passages where they sometimes would have to get off of their beast of burden and be able to walk in front of or behind them, because they could not pass through this particular area, even sitting on their mule or their donkey. It was a narrow, confined space. And Jesus says, getting to heaven involves a narrow, confined, difficult, straight way. What does that indicate to us? Gary? Right. Right. Over in that Matthew 19, 24, where Gary's referencing, where Jesus says that it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into heaven. There's difficulty. What does that indicate? There's choices. That's what we're talking about here. There's choices that you have to make. Sometimes those choices are not easy. That's exactly what Jesus is saying. Adeline? Right? Yeah. It is an everyday effort. There is striving we've got to do every day. And somebody says, wow, that doesn't make being a Christian very appealing. How would you deal with that? That's not very appealing. This is a struggle. Say it again. There's a reward at the end. What'd you say, Allison? It really isn't. Wait a minute, Jesus said it's difficult. How can you say it's, I agree with you, but how can you say it's not a hard life? Once you've made that choice, once you've made the choice of the path you're going to walk, does it get easier after that? I've made up my mind. This is what I'm going to do. Dirk, you had your hand up, and then Stephen. Well, the alternative's even worse. Absolutely, Stephen. Right. And when you when you make this choice to walk the narrow path, are you traveling that path by yourself? You feel like it sometimes you're traveling it by yourself. Sure. Okay. How many people did Jesus say were going to be on this path? There are few who find it. Okay? Are you by yourself? No, there's others on the path with you. But even if you don't see others on the path with you, who's the most important person on the path with you? Jesus Christ is right there. And somebody says, well, I don't see him. Okay? You don't know that he's there with you? Do you know that he's supplying your strength to get through this? You know, when I was growing up, and my dad loved to go out west every summer, and we'd go out to Montana, Colorado, two trips to Alaska, and we'd go on these hikes, through. Can you imagine there being snow in the summer? But we'd go on these hikes through these snow-covered mountains. We'd go on these hikes on glaciers, and you know, when you're a little kid and you're from West Palm Beach, Florida, and you take a step and your foot goes down into the snow, goes down into the glacier, that's kind of intimidating. It's like, okay, that's interesting. But most of the time what was happening is Dad was in front taking the steps. And so you know where we stepped? We just stepped wherever he stepped. Because wherever he stepped, he found solid ground eventually. And so we just stepped wherever he stepped, and we knew that was going to be a solid place to step. When you're walking this narrow path, are you by yourself? Is there somebody that's walking with you, showing you the way? You're not alone. Fran and then John. Yeah. Right. Yep. That poem about the footprints. Say, you know, you only have that one foot set of footprints, Lord, in all those hardest times, you know, there's only one set there. And what did he say? That's when I was carrying you, John. Yeah. So we've got to humble ourselves in order to make it through. But think about what Allison said. Is it true? If Jesus says it's difficult, could we ever say that it's easy? Could it be easy? When you've made the choice on what path you're going to walk. You know, sometimes just making the choice, making a decision is sometimes the hardest thing to do. But once you've made that decision, does that make it easier? Is it easier when somebody else makes a decision for you? Did your parents ever make decisions for you? Maybe you didn't like them. But once they made that decision, it made it easier. When you're trying to decide where to go to lunch or to go to dinner, if your husband or wife would just make the decision for you, doesn't that just make it easier, right? It's like, all right, perfect, that's where we're going. If they just make the decision for you, then it's easier. So sometimes it's you make the decision and then it's easier. But let me ask you this. Do your kids do they need rules? Do they need boundaries to keep them hemmed in, to keep them where they need to be, to keep them from doing what they don't need? But do they need the boundaries? Do they need the rules? Why? Why do they need those? For safety, for protection. When we're walking the narrow path, why is it narrow? Because there's boundaries. Are those boundaries there negatively for us to say, oh no, we can't do that. Oh, well, Jesus won't let me do that. Why does God put those boundaries there? For our good always. Deuteronomy 6 and verse 24. So if we submit to this narrow path, we say, you know what? This is great. I don't have to worry about what's over there. I don't have to worry about what's over there. I'm just going to stick right here, and this is where I want to be. And when I make the decision, this is what I'm going to do. When I make up my mind, it's not out of duty that I'm doing this, but out of desire that I'm doing this, all of a sudden it gets easier. Not that it is easy, but it gets easier. So what's the contrast with this? The wide gate. What's the difference between the narrow and the wide? Here's the wide. Oh, there you go. We got another. Go figure, right? Every phone in here. All right. Yeah. Awesome. Y'all want to go down in the basement? That's what I thought. Tasha? All right, say that again. Is that true? That's to Allison's point. Practicing difficult things makes it easier. Why do baseball teams practice? I mean, don't they know how to swing a bat and to catch a ball and to throw it? I mean, seriously, how hard is that? Why do they practice? Adeline? Yeah. Yeah. That's right. That's right. So when this path that's been laid out in front of us, when we continually, as Tasha says, as we continually practice these things, it becomes easier. It becomes something that we want to do. It becomes something that we long to do because we are looking towards the end. When you have your sight set on the end of the path, if you ran track at all, you had your sight set on the end. And knowing that that's where you were going. Now, this wide path, anything required to walk on that? Are there any boundaries, any limitations on that? It seems today you're learning about things in the last few years you never thought you'd ever learn about, right? You're hearing about things in the last few years. You're like, where'd that come from? Well, it's that wide path that's just getting wider. There's more things that are becoming a part of it because anything goes on the wide path. And now you're learning about anything of anything. Anything goes on that wide path. Doesn't take any effort to walk on it. But notice the contrast. It is striking to me, the contrast that Jesus draws between many and few. What's his point? There are, in comparison's sake, there are few who are going to heaven compared to the many who are walking down the path that's leading to destruction. Don't let the word destruction, some people will focus on that word and say, oh, that means they're going to be annihilated. It means they're going to go out of existence. That's not what the word means. The word destruction just simply means that they are going to lose all well-being. Their substance, their being is just they're going to suffer ruin, not annihilation, as some people would have you to believe. But is not hell the ultimate loss of all well-being for all of eternity? And so Jesus says, you've got to choose. As his focus is on eternity, he says, you've got to choose a path. You've got to choose what path you're going to be on. Then you get to this section, verses 15 through 20. And some people who have a wrong view of Jesus are uncomfortable with these verses. Does that make sense? Here's a teaching of Jesus. Somebody says, oh boy, that kind of makes me uncomfortable. Really? Jesus is talking about the dangers of false teachers and watching out for false prophets. We live in a world today where it's not nice to call somebody a false teacher. Not nice to presume that there are individuals who might be false prophets. And yet, what does he say in verse 15? Beware of false prophets. Did God ever warn of false prophets in the Old Testament? Yeah, all throughout the Old Testament. Are there going to be warnings about false teachers and false prophets anywhere else in the New Testament? Yeah, all the way through. So God is telling us that don't believe every teacher. 1 John 4 and verse 1. Don't believe every teacher. Don't believe everybody who says something. You've got to test them. You've got to try them. What does Jesus tell us about these false teachers? They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves. Are they deceptive? How can you tell? How can you tell if they're a false teacher? On the outside, they're kind of looking normal. You know, maybe what they're saying might sound familiar. You remember what Paul said about the devil and about the devil's ministers and what they're able to do in 2 Corinthians chapter 11? How the devil is able to appear as an angel of light? Isn't that amazing? I mean, I thought the devil was just a red guy with a pitchfork and a pointy tail, right? If you saw a red guy with horns and a pitchfork and a ponytail coming after you, how would you respond? Would you be like, hey, good to see you. Hey, you want to get some coffee? I mean, would you flee from the devil if he came to you in that way? Sure. But when he comes as an angel of light, what does that mean? Ooh. Now I've got to look a little bit closer. Got to try a little bit harder. Because when he comes as an angel of light and he says, hey, David, do this. If he was in a red suit, I'd be like, no way, man. But when he comes as an angel of light, I'm like, that kind of looks good. That looks like a good idea. Maybe I should try that. And he says his angels, his ministers, are able to present themselves as ministers of righteousness. What does that indicate? They fake it. We need to be individuals who would be discerned. How can you detect? How can you identify somebody who's a false teacher? And be objective in this. But how can you identify somebody who's a false teacher? Say again, Dirk. Okay, so lay what they're teaching against God's word. Mickey, what were you? Okay. Somebody say something over here. Okay, doing what the Bereans were doing in Acts 17, Adeline? Okay, so you all are saying the same thing. So we take what they are saying and we lay it down next to what God says and we compare the two. Aren't you glad that God gave us the Bible? It gives us everything that we... Now, can you imagine being a Christian in the first century? You didn't have the completed New Testament. How are you going to know if somebody is telling you the truth? Well, they'd have to do a miracle in order to prove that they're from God so that you would believe that their words are from God. But now we have it better than they... We think... Some people think, oh, we don't have miracles today. They had it better than we do. No, we've got it better than they did. Because we've got the full, complete revelation of God. They did not. You've got the whole Bible. And so we lay down, here's what somebody's saying, here's what the Bible says, and I look at what God says, and I take that and use it to judge. Oh, wait a minute, judge? I thought verse 1 said judge not. Right? So here's what somebody says, here's what... I'm not supposed to judge them, right? Because the first verse says don't judge. I'm supposed to judge. John 7 verse 24, I'm supposed to judge with a righteous judgment. What does a righteous judgment look like? A righteous judgment takes the righteous judgments in the Bible given to us by God and it lays them down next, not only down next to their words, by their fruits you will know them. Fruits are not just their words. Fruits are the results of their words, the results of their teaching, their conduct. How can you identify somebody who's a false teacher? Not just by their words. Do they teach the full counsel of God? Oh, they don't teach everything the Bible says. Do they omit certain sections? Oh, yeah, they don't teach that part of the Bible. Can you look at somebody's conduct and say that their conduct leads me not to follow their words because of how they are behaving? Can I look at somebody's associations and who they're with? Oh, wait a minute. If they're over here, then they're not... Jesus says, look at their fruits. Somebody says, you're not supposed to judge. Well, Jesus does tell us to judge. He tells us to judge using God's word as our standard of judgment. And he tells us in this section to be fruit inspectors. If you walk up to an apple tree, can you tell which apple you're going to pull off to eat? If you walk up to an orange tree, can you tell what you're going to pull off? If you go blueberry picking, you go strawberry picking, you know which ones you're going to pick and which ones you're not. Oh, you're being judgmental. No, you're using the brain that God gave you to figure this out. God says we got to be a fruit inspector. We only got a couple minutes. Look at verse 21. Verse 21 is a key section here, and I wish we had more time to go into this. But as Jesus says to focus in on eternity, he says you've got to do the will of God. A key verse in all of the New Testament is Matthew 7, verse 21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven. Well, Jesus, who in the world is going to enter the kingdom of heaven then? I mean, surely somebody who is calling upon Jesus as their Lord, surely that person is going to go to heaven. And Jesus says, no, it's not enough just to make a confession. It's not enough just to make some kind of a verbal appeal to Jesus. You've got to do, and I told you that was a key word in this section, you've got to do the will of your Father in heaven. Is it possible that some people think they are doing the will of God, but they are not? Is that possible? Yeah, Jesus says that in verse 22. What's the first word you have in verse 22? Many. Same word we saw over in chapter 7 verse 13, many are on that wide path that leads to destruction. The same word. You think Jesus is given to hyperbole? He's just exaggerating, right? Jesus doesn't do that. Many will say unto me on that day, on the day of judgment, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name? Have we not cast out demons in your name? Have we not done many wonders in your name? What does Jesus say? What am I going to say to them? Three things in verse 23. I never knew you. Does that mean Jesus isn't very smart? Does that mean he's ignorant of people? No. Saying I never knew you is simply a way of saying you were never in a right relationship with me. You are not in a right relationship with me. I have not approved of the way that you are living. Depart from me, cast from his very presence, because you are somebody who, even though you think you're doing something in my name, instead you have been practicing lawlessness. We need to be ever so cautious that we make sure we don't just think we're doing the will of God. We've got to get in and make sure we are. Otherwise, we could be like these individuals. We might be sincere. We might think that we're doing what's right. But Jesus says, if you're not doing the will of God, you're not going to heaven. And we don't have time for the last section. But you know those verses about the builders. There's two kind of hearers, two kind of builders. It is not enough just to hear what Jesus says. We've got to do what Jesus says. And when he was done preaching, they realized there's something different about him. This man preaches with authority. May God help us to respect and obey the authority of Christ. Thank you all very much for your attention this morning.